In the manic days that followed the phone call from Pat Scales and the heady weeks thereafter, I have said to myself many times on different occasions, so this is what it's like to win the Newbery. I said it when a stranger called one morning, scarcely before my eyes were open, to ask if she could drop by with her manuscript. I said it when David Wisner and I were warned, just before we went on TV together, that there could be, quote, no long pauses in which to think. I said it when a photographer asked me to climb up our box elder to pose, then took the ladder away. I said it every evening for 3 weeks when I carried all the bouquets I had received up into a spare bedroom and retrieved them again the next morning, so that our cat, the one that ate the 40 yards of Christmas ribbon, would not devour the leaves. But now I stand before you in delight and wonder and say to myself, no, this is what it's like to win the Newbery. In those first stunned moments after the phone call, my mouth full of cereal, I began to wonder if I had imagined it. My husband was out jogging, and our two cats went on yawning and preening themselves on the rug, oblivious to the wild-eyed woman who stood with one hand over the telephone and the other over her stomach. If this is true, I finally told myself, someone else will call. The phone did ring again, the Today Show, asking me to come to New York that evening. At some point, Rex returned, and I remember telling him that I had 24 hours to lose 30 pounds, but those first few days are a fog of elation, sleeplessness, and the constant ringing of the phone. Thank you, Pat, and all the other members of the Newbery Committee, as well as the American Library Association. Thank you not only for loving Marty Preston and his dog as much as I do, but for not calling me in the middle of the night to tell me so. Thank you, John Landman, for recognizing that I need time for my family and myself, as well as the books I love. Thanks for your excellent editing, your generous praise, and your sense of humor. I doubt you remember what your acceptance letter for Shiloh said, but here it is. Dear Phyllis, you have struck a dog lover at his weakest point. I think Shiloh is marvelous and will get the ball rolling for a contract. There are a few minor points we can discuss after that. Judd's turnaround at the end might be a tad fast, for example. But on the whole, I think the novel works very well, right down to that windshield wiper of a tale. Lucy, my 11-year-old Labrador, salutes you. And then, in typical Landman fashion, there was Lucy's paw print along with John's signature. I may be the only author in the world whose acceptance letter was co-signed by a dog. To properly begin my thank yous, I should really start with my parents, who are no longer alive to hear them. Thank you, Mother and Dad, for reading aloud to us every night, as far back as I can remember. Mother with her Midwestern accent, Dad in his Mississippi drawl. Thank you for the drama in your voices as you recounted the adventures of Tom Sawyer and Becky Thatcher, of Huckleberry Finn and Jim, the Prince and the Pauper, the Mad March Hare, Mother West Wind's children, the Bobbsey twins, and the Israelites on their journey to the Promised Land. I was never interested in the authors. It was the story that was important. Thank you, John Reynolds, for being younger, so that long after I felt I was too old to snuggle down beside you and Mother on the couch every evening, I could still sit at the dining room table doing my homework and laugh with you over Toad and his motor car. Thanks to my sister Norma for teaching me to draw so that I could illustrate my little books, even the one I wrote at age 9 after Mother told me the facts of life, which I titled Manual for Pregnant Women with Illustrations by the Author. Thank you, Jean Carl, for your faith in me when you took my first book for Athenaeum, Witch's Sister. Thank you, even though my witch books seem to frighten some people who have never read them. Long ago, as a fledgling author, my aim was someday to write for Jean Carl. Since then, I have written and written and written, and you allowed me to try even those books which we both knew would not be especially popular because you realized I was saying something that just had to get out. Thank you for your ability to articulate so well what it is that keeps a manuscript from being its best. Thank you both, John and Jean, for putting up with my confusion about time. For a woman who has a clock, sometimes two, in every room of the house, including the basement, and almost as many calendars, who usually knows how she is going to spend every 15-minute segment of her day, I cannot explain why I have such trouble with time in my manuscripts, as shown by this comment in a letter from Jean Carl about my book, Alice in Rapture, Sort of. At the start, one must assume that that first day is sometime during at least the second week of vacation. The sleepover could be the Friday of the second week of vacation, but that would make it near the end of June already. Patrick's birthday then has to come during the third week of vacation. Are we getting into July? A week later, the permanent has to be in the fourth week of vacation, surely well into July. Yet on page 67, there are still 2 months of vacation left, and on 82, it is still the middle of July, and a lot seems to have happened in between. On page 92, it is still the middle of July, but then on 93, it is the first week of August. One problem of mine is that I want to squeeze too much into a single lifetime. I don't seem to mind very much squandering a few dollars, but if I waste 60 minutes, I know it is something I will never get back. And then I have that troop of noisy characters in my head to contend with, all nattering away, demanding a place in a book, and it's enough to make my teeth rattle. What shall I tell you about Shiloh? If it were my book, The Keeper, receiving the award, I could tell you how it was adapted from a chapter in my own life, and that would take up the rest of this talk. If it were A String of Chances, I could tell you about my struggles with faith. If it were Send No Blessings, I could talk of the numerous drafts it took to work out Beth's problems with self-esteem. But Shiloh, the first draft, that is, was written at breakneck speed. It was as though I were obsessed with getting to the end of the story and finding out just what happened between Marty and Judd Travers, as though Marty himself were perched on the arm of my chair, telling me the story in his own way. As with most of my books, however, the roots of this one go deep. In many of my other books, I deal with problems I wrestled with as a child or teenager, but in the writing of Shiloh, I was dealing with discomfort that was still new. Many of you already know the story behind it, how my husband and I were visiting friends in West Virginia and rose one morning for a long walk in the little community known as Shiloh, how we had passed the old grist mill and crossed the bridge, and just beyond the schoolhouse we found the hungry, trembling, and strangely silent dog that was eventually to become Shiloh in my book. How it was so frightened and beaten down, it kept slinking away from us, but how finally, when I whistled, it inexplicably came bounding over, leaping up to lick my cheek. How it followed us back to the house of our friends and sat out all day in the rain, head on its paws, watching the door. How I agonized all the way back to Maryland that evening until finally my husband said, "Well, Phyllis, are you going to have a nervous breakdown, or are you going to do something about it?" The something, of course, meant writing, which was a catharsis for me, but did nothing for the dog. I want to thank Rex at this point for not putting me out of the car that day. I want to thank him for listening all these years to my dark nights of the soul, for his loving encouragement and his intelligent criticism of every book manuscript I've ever written. As for Shiloh, whatever saint looks out for strays must have had his eye on this one, because a few weeks into the story, a note from our friends said that they had encountered the dog again a few days after we left, brought it home, and named it Clover. So why didn't I put my manuscript aside and say, "Fine, it's settled then"? Because I got hooked on that dog, as Marty would say, whistling as though I meant something, than offering nothing. I felt I owed it more. The second reason I couldn't let go of the story was that while we talked about the dog that day with our hosts, Frank and Trudy Madden, They had patiently explained that the animal sitting out in the yard was only one of many the owners abandoned in those hills. And though they didn't say so, I knew Frank and Trudy were thinking that here I was upsetting us all by focusing on this particular dog, ignoring what they had to deal with often. I wanted to write about how, once you become emotionally involved in a problem, all bets are off. Your perspective changes. "Open up your eyes, Marty. Open your eyes," his father tells him. "How many times have you walked to the school bus and seen a chained-up dog in somebody's yard? How many times you ever put your mind to whether or not it's happy, its ribs sticking out like handles at the sides? Suddenly you're face to face with a dog that pulls at your heart and you all at once want to change things." And so I went on with my story. I didn't want to add any more to the Maddens' burdens than I already had, so I did not ask them the research questions they might easily have answered. Instead, I wrote letters to all the West Virginia agencies that could give me information, one of them the small post office in the town of Friendly, where I inquired about a postman's routine, the kind of vehicle he might drive, postal routes, and other facts I would need to portray Marty's father. Imagine my chagrin when I got a letter back with the necessary information from Frank Madden. The harried postmistress simply turned my letter over to him and asked if he had the knowledge and time to answer this lady's letter. As the novel progressed, I discovered that it also dealt with justice. One reason that writing for children is satisfying is that they may, in reading your book, face a new idea for the first time. And when you consider that there can only be one first time, you realize that the impact of that encounter may affect a child's thinking for the rest of his life. If he sees the world as black and white, he may develop knee-jerk reactions to keywords or slogans. If he determines that the end justifies the means, his ethics may tend to slip and slide. But if he sees that much of life is more complex than he thought, that each problem must be approached in its unique situation, and that he must base his actions not only upon his family's values, but upon his own innate sense of what is true and good, then he will get a taste of what being an adult really means. From the absolutes of early childhood, through the growing awareness that there are exceptions, and on to the realization that much of life is, of necessity, compromise, the child, if he is to mature, must leave his comforting stereotypes behind him. When should he give in, and for what principles should he hold out? While Marty eventually comes to the conclusion that Jesus would not want him to turn the beagle back over to Judd Travers, it does not solve his problem of deceit. Where is the dividing line between lawful duty and being true to one's conscience, between loyalty to one's family and the love of a dog? When I was a child, I first faced the problem of justice in the Old Testament. When the Ark of the Covenant was being moved, the Bible tells us, the oxen stumbled and it started to tip. Uzzah reached out to steady it and was immediately struck dead. I was indignant. Never mind that God had commanded that no one touch it. Didn't anyone get points for using his head? Apart from God's justice, however, my punishment, for all the contributions I had not made to the Humane Society, was a guilt that got heavier the more I wrote. What if Clover, who turned out to be female in real life, barked all night? What if she got in fights with other dogs? What if she killed the Madden's cat? And speaking of justice, what kind of justice was it that I was going to get a book out of all this, but my friends were stuck with the dog? Should I send them a check? Offer to pay Clover's medical bills? Change the dedication in the book to Frank and Trudy Madden with thanks and 10%? Gradually, however, as the book took shape, I remembered the love of our Springer Spaniel when we were growing up, and how there is nothing comparable to a dog that sits at your feet, follows you about, is prepared to be sad with you or rejoice with you, even give its life for you all at a moment's notice. I decided finally that having a dog may be its own reward. But my battles went on. At every turn, it seemed, in the final chapters and in subsequent drafts, I found still another way that Judd might try to trick Marty. Another way that Marty could win and yet lose at the same time. I had to discover, like him, that nothing is as simple as you guess, not right or wrong, not Judd Travers, not even Marty himself or the dog. And so the book was finished. If a mother-to-be has visions of producing the next president of the United States, that takes second place to her hope that the child is born healthy with a proper number of fingers and toes. The same is true of a writer. If she occasionally daydreams about the Newbery, that is second compared to her earnest wish to see the book published at last, with all its paragraphs intact. Up to this point, she knows where her manuscript is at all times, with the editor, the copy editor, the marketing people, the illustrator. She can check and make sure it's still breathing. But suddenly, sooner than she thinks, it is out in the world on its own. It is trucking down a highway in Oklahoma toward towns she never heard of. It is being dangled upside down in a bookstore by a 3-year-old with jelly on her fingers. It is cozying up to a boy with green spiked hair. She has sent it off to boarding school, and the most she can hope for is a report now and then from a reviewer, or even more wonderful, an honest letter from a child. But this time, with this book, the best news of all. I realize what an honor it is to be here with Avi and Russell Friedman, and I'm still trembly. I would like to thank Maureen Hayes, my guardian angel at Athenaeum, just for being herself, and for the wonderful friends I have made over the years as she sent me on speaking tours to libraries around the country. Thank you to those same librarian friends for your many warm letters since the Newbery was announced. I may not be able to connect all your names and faces, but I remember the pieces of your lives you shared with me, as I shared mine with you, while we drove from city to city, school to school. As I said, it's the story, to me, that's important. Thanks to Judy Wilson of the Macmillan Children's Book Group, and all those people in its many departments who have assisted at the births of my books. And finally, thanks to our two sons, Jeff and Michael. Jeff, for realizing how important this award was to me when I telephoned you with the news. Mike, for your usual irreverence when you said, after listening to me babble on about it, "Mom, have you ever won this award before?" You both, along with your families, have added new dimensions to my books and my life. A year ago, I was speaking to a school assembly where the children had been warned to be on their best behavior. They would not ask any embarrassing questions, the principal assured me, certainly not how much money I made, and definitely not my age, which always seems a little severe to me because how else are they going to know? So during the question-answer session, they asked the usual. How many books had I written? 70. Had I ever won any awards? Some. Had I ever won the Newbery? No. At this last answer, a small boy in the second row, to the horror of the teachers, rose up on his knees and crowed disdainfully, 70 books, and she's never won the Newbery. Well, now I have, and along with my marriage to Rex, the births of our sons, and the arrival of my word processor, it's about the nicest thing that ever happened to me. I thank you with all my heart.